Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is Professor Mark Smith of the University of South Carolina, where he's Distinguished Professor of History. And we're going to talk a little bit about 19th century American history, which is one of his many specialties, and about a native son of South Carolina, Andrew Jackson, the 7th President of the United States. So with that introduction, Mark, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter. Always good to be here.
Well, in June of this year, June 14 through 23rd, Greenville's June Chautauqua Festival will take place. And among the participants coming home to South Carolina is Andrew Jackson. And so we thought it might be appropriate to talk about this native son who has continued for more than a century and a half to be in the news. Mark, as someone studying American history in the UK, what did you learn as an undergraduate about Andrew Jackson?
Well, Jackson, at least in my particular education, didn't figure terribly prominently. I mean, if you think about the high points of the American presidency, at least from a foreign perspective, it usually lights on people like Washington and Lincoln, and of course Kennedy. But coming here, you realize that Jackson occupies a rather interesting place in the kind of broad swath of 19th century U.S. history. The one way that you do encounter Jackson in Britain is courtesy of travel accounts, because in the 1830s and certainly the 1820s, lots of European visitors came to the United States, Brits especially, in an effort to fathom what on earth this new country was about. And the connection there to Jackson is quite important because Jackson and the age of Jackson is often characterized as an age of extraordinary growth in democracy and participation, which, of course, from our perspective, it isn't that, but from the perspective of people at the time, it was. And one reason that that idea of the age of Jackson, the age of the common man, gained such traction is because of what foreign visitors said about what was going on in America.
We're talking about Alexis de Tocqueville, for example.
That's exactly right. And there are many, many smaller, lesser-known authors and travelers who were here simply to observe. And of course, from their perspective, America did look vibrantly democratic. You have the reduction of property qualifications, not just for voting in the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s especially, but also for office holding. And at the same time, you've got places like Great Britain who are experimenting with their own Great Reform Act. There's one in 1832 and one in 1867, another one in the 1880s. But you'll notice the difference between the American experiment and the British one is that the British one was much more incremental and slower. And from the British perspective, there seemed to be this very sudden evolution of a democratic process, a democratic participation. And from that perspective, I try to tell my students, it looked more democratic than elsewhere, even though in an absolute sense, of course, women and African Americans couldn't vote. But increasingly, white men could, regardless of whether or not they owned property.
And of course, one of the first, if not the first states to grant universal white male suffrage was South Carolina in 1810.
That's right.
And South Carolina was a stronghold of Jacksonian support.
It certainly had that Jacksonian support, although, of course, 4 years into Jackson's first term, just beginning his second, he encounters what is arguably one of the greatest sources of resistance to his presidency, which emanates from South Carolina in the form of John C. Calhoun.
And the nullification crisis.
That's right.
But we'll get to that in a minute, but I wanted to go back when you talked about the age of Jackson, because when I was going through graduate school in the 1960s, actually as an undergraduate, we read John Ward's The Age of Jackson. I'm sorry, that was The Age of Jackson with Schlesinger, one of the most progressive historians of the early post-World War II period. Jackson was a hero, and if you talked about the era of the common man, he fought the bank. He was not from the elite of the East Coast. He made no bones about being rough-hewn, whether you're talking about his frontier experience, the Battle of New Orleans. But that's That's part of the story. And the fact that his inaugural reception was a grand melee, if there ever was one. It sent shudders up and down the New Englanders' spines. He was not one of them. He wasn't one of the Lowcountry elite from Virginia or South Carolina. But, you know, the age of Jackson, or John Ward's, was Andrew Jackson, symbol of an age. I mean, that was the picture of Jackson in American history, or as it was taught, from, I'd say, World War II till almost the end of the 20th century.
Well, and I think in a curious fashion, that symbolism has been resurrected recently. Jackson's attracted a great deal of attention in the past few years, John Meacham's biography being most conspicuous. And he, too, says that the age of Jackson was very much indexed to the kind of quirkiness and personalities of the man who presided over that era. And if you think about Van Buren, Jackson's successor, he was really an extension of Jacksonian policy in many ways.
Well, and not to mention James K. Polk.
That's right. And I think in that regard, there is a, as with many things that historians do, a kind of poetic coming back to an original point. So there is, I think, something to be said for that. But part of the reason you can say that about Jackson is because he was such a complicated person in a complicated age. And I think it's often very easy to square complications because contradictions don't always make sense, and you can cherry pick your analysis as you like. So Jackson was very much a contradiction, as was the age itself. I mean, you have a very provincial man from a very small place who becomes arguably the most nationalist president of the 19th century, with possibly the exception of Lincoln. You have a man who can be tender and kind, but also with an enormous appetite for cruelty and violence. You have a man who is a very profitable slave owner, who's very canny financially, who owns a merchant store, but who hates commercial institutions like the National Bank. And of course, he's presiding over an era where America's becoming knitted together through internal improvements, railroads, roads, postal office. But it's also a period in which you get the emergence of states' rights and sectionalism and a consciousness of particularism in place. You have massive immigration in this period, at least beginning in the 1840s, and the kind of blush of Jacksonian America. And you also have massive forced migration, courtesy of Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears. So I think the entire era, courtesy in part of the man, but also as a result of these very powerful modernizing forces, is a complicated, complex time where the contradictions abound.
One of the, and this is again back to the idea of the age of Jackson, one of the most prominent historians of the post-World War II period, Leonard D. White, wrote a three-volume series on administrative politics and history in America. That's, and as an undergraduate, I read them. I couldn't do that now. That's cruel and unusual punishment. They were horribly boring. Mm. But he divided the pre-Civil War period into the Federalists, fair enough, 1789 to 1801, the Jeffersonians, 1801 to 1828, and the Jacksonians from 1829 to 1861. Mm-hmm. And I went back and flipped through my undergraduate book, and part of it has to do with the introduction of the spoils system. But basically, White makes the argument it wasn't just Van Buren and Polk, but all of his successors, whether they were Whigs or Democrats, pretty much followed the Jackson model.
Oh,
they weren't nearly as strong, but I mean, in terms of what he had set forth, they weren't going to mess with.
No, I think that's largely right. I mean, of course, political patronage had always been something that presidents had used, but I think what Jackson did was two things. First, he was very happy to use patronage as a form of influence to embolden and empower the presidency and his office. And secondly, he used the power of veto more than anybody else prior to his administrations. to make it very clear that the authority, as he defined it, rested with him. So what you have, I think, is a much more muscular presidency that's willing to use patronage, that's willing to use the prerogatives of the office in a way to, I think, appeal to his larger nationalistic ideology, but also to empower his party. And really, this is the beginning of the party system proper, in which you have the emergence of professional politicians. They had been there before, of course.
All right, let's stop for a minute and explain to folks what was how one got to be nominated president before this time, before party conventions and what have you. Obviously, Washington's selection as president was foregone. But within his two terms, parties began to develop. But you're nominated by either a party caucus in Congress or you're nominated by a legislature. Mm-hmm. So that's how you get Jefferson. That's how you get Madison. You get Monroe. You get John Quincy Adams. And interestingly, in that election of 1824, you have John C. Calhoun running for president. And he thinks he's established a national network. He used the patronage of the War Department, and he was Secretary of War under Monroe. People like Lewis Cass in Michigan and so forth, he thought he had quite a network, and he was going to be nominated by the legislature of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, Andrew Jackson is nominated by his campaign manager.
Yes.
And so Calhoun drops out. Yeah. But by the time we get to 1828, we're looking at a party convention, mm-hmm. something that Martin Van Buren, he may not have created it, but he certainly helped fuel it. But you've got this link between a real politician from New York. Martin Van Buren was a model New York politician, mm-hmm. almost a caricature. Mm-hmm. Linking up with Andrew Jackson, I mean, they could not have been more diametrically opposed in terms of background or anything else. But they knit together a national party.
They do, and I do think it's worth pausing on this 1824 election just briefly. So that the way that worked is it was William Crawford who was nominated by the caucus. And
William Crawford was from Georgia.
From Georgia.
Secretary of Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like Calhoun, he had lots of patronage at his disposal.
He did.
Which he used, and he thought he also had created a national network.
Yes, he had. And then there were the relatively young Turks who emerged by critiquing the implicit corruption of the caucus system, and that included Calhoun, but also included John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay of Kentucky. And they styled themselves the New Nationalists, and they lobbied outside of the caucus. They thought the caucus was unfair in advancing Crawford, and of course they were using their own patronage too and their own networks. And at first, Jackson was considered to be an idiosyncratic candidate, really. As you say, a kind of frontiersman, a rough-and-tumble chap whose fame principally resided as a military officer.
But he's also a United States senator.
He is also a United States senator. But people really didn't take him terribly seriously at first. And then very quickly, keen observers recognized that folks in the South and the West in particular were beginning to gravitate towards him. And in a way, I think that Jackson's 1828 victory began with his loss in 1824. Because the way that it worked out, and I can't remember the numbers exactly, but Jackson got 99 Electoral College votes in 1824.
He also overwhelmingly got the popular vote, but that's kind of misleading.
That doesn't mean the same thing then as it does now. But nonetheless, rhetorically, that's how he framed it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? I am the popular president. Mm-hmm. And I think John Quincy Adams got 84.
Something like that, yeah.
And then Calhoun dropped out. Crawford got 40-something and Clay got 37, something like that.
And Crawford by this time, by the way, was sadly pretty much in a vegetative state. He'd had a stroke.
That's right.
But his people stuck with him.
They stuck with him. That's right. But I'm hoping to elevate a man they could control.
So nobody had a majority of electoral votes.
No.
And for the only time in American history, it goes to the House.
It goes to the House. And who's Speaker of the House? It's Henry Clay.
Henry Clay.
And Jackson always believed, until his death in 1845, that Clay and John Quincy Adams had struck a deal, which he conveniently labeled the corrupt bargain. And the idea was that Clay had arranged for the House to vote to elevate John Quincy Adams to the presidency, and in return, John Quincy Adams appointed Clay Secretary of State, which, of course, back then was the stepping stone to the presidency.
Yes, his predecessors had all been Secretary of State and moved.
And it was a natural order. I think Jackson's genius here, part of it is one of his sort of utter frustration and anger, but he used that loss to make a campaign platform. And the campaign platform was simply, and almost exclusively, we must rid Washington of corruption. This is a dereliction of duty on the part of the establishment, and we're going to shake things up. And so almost as soon as that election was over, Jackson starts running. And not just Jackson, but his campaign managers. And, you know, you get the development of rallies and newspapers. These things had happened before, but not on the same scale.
There was a media campaign. It was in those days, it was easy enough to establish a newspaper, although it took some capital. And Jackson's team formed newspapers, not just in Washington, they had a very influence, but they found them all across the country to get the party line out.
That's right. That's right. And this is during the beginnings of the market revolution, where you can circulate information, goods, and services a bit more easily than you could before, say, the War of 1812. So what Jackson's doing is capitalizing on a kind of infrastructure revolution, in part to circulate ideas about why he's been robbed and why he should win in 1828. And he uses it to great effect. And, of course, I often think that's one of the reasons he was quite sympathetic to some of the internal improvements that he championed later on, which tended to be more national in scale and not local. Partly for that reason, I think. He saw it as a machine, and the machine needed to be national.
David and Gene Heidler have recently come out with a book last fall, The Rise of Andrew Jackson, Myth, Manipulation, and the Making of Modern Politics.
Mm-hmm.
I think it may be a little bit overdrawn, but there's a kernel of truth there.
Well, comparing modern politics to Jackson is a very seductive invitation, isn't it? Because there does seem to be lots of similarities, both rhetorically and practically. And I think that there probably are. But it's worth bearing in mind the fundamental differences between modern America and, you know, the United States between 1828 and 1861, if you want to take it that far. And they were manifest. The differences were great. But nonetheless, I think there are some strings that you can attach between that era and ours, and the making of a modern political machine would be one of them.
Eventually, certainly not in 1828, but thereafter, once Calhoun is out of the picture, is Martin Van Buren, the sly fox.
It is. The little magician, who was a very careful student of those around him, was very careful in befriending certain people, principally when Jackson was president, in an effort to temper Jackson and impress him and wed his alliance to him. That would be especially true with the Eaton affair, the Petticoat affair, where he sided with Jackson's support of Eaton, the Secretary of State, and his difficult wife, or at least perceived difficult wife.
You know, that's one of those things we used to laugh at undergraduates, you know, history's made in bed. Well, this is where that certainly played a role in the making of one man's career and the destruction of another.
Well, you talk about the connection to modern politics, Walder. I mean, you know, where the personal is political. That certainly was the case with Peggy Eaton, and certainly is the case in more modern times.
Well, I think we need to replay the story because it's one of those things that folks in South Carolina need to understand that have certainly affected the course of our state's history.
Right.
Peggy Eaton was a married woman who ran a tavern in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
her husband died, and the senator from Tennessee, Mr. Eaton, who was a close friend of Andrew Jackson, dated her and then decided to marry her.
Hmm.
Okay. At this point, Andrew Jackson is a widower. There is no first lady. And the vice president is John C. Calhoun, and sort of by the rules of the day, Mrs. Vice President Calhoun was the social leader of Washington.
Hmm.
Well, she put out the word that no one should receive the Eaton hussy.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't happen. Well, Mrs. Eaton cries to her husband, who then comes to see the president, who is irate because, of course, he's been through the ringer with accusations made about his wife being an adulteress and what have you.
That's the key. Mm.
And he calls in John C. Calhoun and tells him, orders him to order his wife to receive Mrs. Eaton. Well, Calhoun goes home, you know, dear, you really need to do this. And she said, no, packed up her bags, returned to South Carolina, and never set foot in Washington, D.C. again. And this is where Van Buren comes in, because he all of a sudden starts talking about other things about Calhoun. Right now, Calhoun and Jackson are very close. It's sort of assumed that, you know, Jackson's old, he's not particularly well. Calhoun is the heir apparent.
Yes.
But Van Buren uses this affair as a way to begin to undermine Calhoun. And later on, as nullification rises, Calhoun resigns and goes home. Conveniently, the General Assembly elects him to a Senate seat, and he's back in Washington. But he is clearly out of favor with Jackson and the folks who are in control.
Yes. Well, I mean, that it is all terribly complicated at a certain level. My sense is that so much of it devolves on the core personality of Jackson. And I think you're entirely right that Jackson doesn't mind, I think, dealing with people who are plain-spoken and to the point. I don't think he likes people tap-dancing around him or trying to evade and misrepresent a position. And I think that's also what motivated him with this petticoat affair, this Eaton affair. Because as you say, during the election of 1828, he was stripped in the press and his wife was vilified, the argument being that she was a bigamist, that they had married before she was divorced formally.
And she died before, during the...
She died in December 1828.
After he had been elected.
Just after.
And he always said she died of a broken heart.
That's right. And he blamed the press for this, that they had been so vicious and so wretched in their condemnation that she was unable to sustain herself. And of course, that opens up this door for the Donaldsons. And Emily Donaldson, who is his niece, basically becomes the hostess for the White House during the first 4 years, at least, of Jackson's first term. And she hates Peggy Eaton. And part of the tension for Jackson here is that his favored niece, his private secretary, her husband, Andrew Donaldson, Jackson Donaldson, they do not like Peggy Eaton, and they are pushing hard, just like Calhoun is, to ostracize Peggy and the Secretary of War, John Eaton. And Jackson's really caught here. He tries to maintain a kind of policy of disengagement, and eventually it comes to a head. And I'm not sure how much Van Buren has to do with the acceleration of this aggravation, but he certainly is a very keen reader of who to support and when. And it does come to a head in which essentially the Donaldsons are sent back, extradited from the White House, albeit briefly. There is a reconciliation later. But Jackson shows a degree of loyalty to Eaton, and I think it's born principally of a terrible experience that he had in 1828. That's true of so much of Jackson, though. His past dictated his future in so many ways. His very source of violence was, I think, rooted in his experience as a child.
Well, almost being killed by an English officer and a gentleman.
He refused to shine his boots.
Yes. The incident during the Revolution where, had Jackson not been quick as a young teenager, and caught the saber with his arm, he would have been killed. His older brother was killed.
That's right. So one of the chief signatures, I think, of Jackson's entire life is a very close and intimate association with violence. As you say, he carries the mark of violence from a young age. He witnesses some appalling scenes during the Revolution with Bannister Tarleton coming through the wax halls.
And in fact, the early biographies or hagiographies that were written about him talked about the bloody war in the back country, not written by Jackson himself, but others to show what he had endured.
That's right. This was no gentleman's war, as you well know, having written on this in some detail. It was a wretched affair, and so he was exposed to violence at a very young age. And of course, he later becomes a substantial slave owner himself, which is retailing in some form of violence as a slave owner. He starts off with 9 and ends up with, I think, over 300 slaves. And he was not shy in dispensing or having dispensed corporal punishment. He dueled and killed a man, some say quite callously. He knew that his challenger was a better shot, and so let that man shoot him first. And that bullet that entered just near his heart stayed with him all his life. And by the rules of the duel, the rules of the game, Jackson simply took a free shot and did so very calmly, without hesitation, and killed his opponent. If you trace it through to 1830, at least, in fact, it has a much deeper genealogy, his treatment of Native Americans was a colossal scale of violence, really, an absolute travesty in the annals of American history. He knew what he was doing. He'd been doing it all his life, in a way. Yes, he'd certainly shown some degree of tenderness towards individuals, but his nationalistic fervor, his determination to preserve this country for the expansion of the white man, led him down this very dark path. And when the Indian Removal Act was signed in 1830, which was by quite a close vote, and Jackson really pushed this through, the fate of thousands, tens of thousands of people was sealed. But he had no hesitation in doing so. He'd been doing it as a soldier, and he saw this as his way to secure the country for expansion. The difficulty for historians, of course, is to judge the past not by our present concerns, but by its own context. So plainly, from our perspective, Indian removal was wretched, but it isn't just by our perspective, Walter. There were people at the time utterly horrified by this prospect, making our good, moral, ethical, legal arguments about why this shouldn't happen. So it's not as though he wasn't criticized for this at the time. He certainly was, and in my opinion, rightly so. And then, of course, the utter abrogation of any sense of commitment to earlier treaties, which Native Americans, of course, had some faith in and believed that they were being told the truth and those treaties were sacrosanct. And essentially, Jackson said they're not. And he even went against the Worcester Supreme Court decision in 1832 and sort of ignored the stipulations of that.
Well, but see, that's interesting is he ignored it, but the state courts did not.
The state courts did not. That's right. Of course, people have been using pretenses all the time for Indian removal, military necessity and what have you. But what Jackson did was systematize it and bring to bear the power of the state to extract a very large population in its entirety and move it west of the Mississippi. But again, this is why I said at the beginning, his principal signature, if you have to look for one thing that Andrew Jackson was, besides having this appetite for violence, was he was an unapologetic nationalist. Pretty much everything that he did was, in his view, in favor of the nation, and not a section, not a particular group of people unless they were voters for him, but something that was of larger consequence, a national idea that really had no limits to its cost.
Do we trace that back to New Orleans? Do we trace that back to the revolution, the idea of a strong central nation, because a backwoods boy, certainly in the Carolinas after the Revolution, would have been anti-Federalist.
He would. I think that his own peculiar experience in the Revolution, his exposure to that level of violence, was important. He also had a very strong paternalistic streak, and he saw himself as both the head of his household, but as a father-like figure to Native Americans. And also to the country as a whole. He often referred to himself as the father of the nation, not in that kind of Washingtonian origination way, but as a custodian of the national spirit, the national progress. So there's something to do with that. But unpacking his psychology, I think, is extraordinarily challenging and fraught, frankly. But he was fairly consistent, I think, on that nationalist impulse of his.
Which, of course, brings him back into South Carolina history and conflict. And I'll let you set the stage for that.
Well, again, as with most things during his administrations, they're quite complex. But fundamentally, the assumption had been, I think from the Revolution, that this was a compact of states, the United States, and that the idea is that the Union would be preeminent, but an important part of that revolutionary generation also recognized the importance of state sovereignty. And this comes to a head, although it had been tested before, in 1828, when a tariff that is perceived to favor, and in fact did favor, New England nascent industrialization.
But who was it that helped push that through?
Well, of course, you know, this is the great irony, that Calhoun was a nationalist before he was a particularist or a states' rightist. And the idea was that the federal government was using its authority to benefit one particular region of the country over another. So tariffs were there to protect New England manufacturing, which, of course, increased the cost of imported manufacturing or manufactured items for the South, and also courted the possibility of tit-for-tat tariffs from Great Britain and France in particular. From this, Calhoun writes and thinks very carefully, to be sure, about what is the responsibility of the federal government towards states and what rights do states have when they perceive the federal government to be impinging on their liberty. And of course, he was not the first person to think about this. Both Jefferson and Madison had discussed this in the resolutions, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798 and 1799. And
the New England had done it during
1817, that's right. So it's not as though this was utterly unusual, but it was the force with which Calhoun and the kind of the elegance, the theoretical elegance that he put forward for nullification and where it led to.
All right. And we need, I think, probably to define nullification.
So the idea, simply put, is that if a state perceived and understood a federal action to be damaging to the liberty of an individual state, that the state reserved the right to nullify that legislation. What Calhoun did was go further, and through a variety of steps, he said, if that nullification doesn't work, then ultimately, following constitutional amendments and what have you, the state has the right to leave the Union. And that's what Jackson and many nationalists found so chilling, because nobody had really articulated that with the same degree of precision or passion up until that point.
The previous attempt at challenging the federal government had come during the Whiskey Rebellion, when George Washington personally led an army into the field.
So, that's right. So there were, one of the difficulties about writing about the coming of the Civil War is that we know the answer, and we know that nationalism triumphs. But in that knowledge, we tend to forget that there was a strong tradition of states' rights and a strong tradition.
Well, we historians we refer to antebellum America. Those folks did not know that they were antebellum pre-Civil War.
No, they did not. There was no bellum, at least not that, well, not that bellum.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to recognize that Calhoun was tagging into a tradition, but at the very same moment he's doing this, America, or at least some Americans, are seeing themselves as more nationalistic than ever. And this is where he butts heads with Jackson. And Jackson is not, and of course, it's also personal as well. I mean, at this point, Jackson is not going to be manipulated by Calhoun. He is not going to be the president that presides over secession or nullification. And he threatens to send troops into South Carolina to enforce national authority.
Well, before we get to that threat, South Carolina not only has the tariff of tariff of abominations, there's also a tariff in 1832, mm-hmm. which is rub salt into the wound.
Right.
So the General Assembly of South Carolina calls for a convention of the people, which is actually something that goes back to very early colonial history in South Carolina, the Revolution of 1719, the convention of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the convention meets and declares the tariff to be null and void, and that South Carolina will not permit customs officials to collect tariffs in Charleston after a certain date.
There's wiggle room.
They give some wiggle room and threaten to use force if need be. Well, part of that, you talk about misreading the times. South Carolinians, you can go back and read the people who attended the convention, thought Jackson was there. He's a fellow Southerner.
That's right.
A South Carolinian.
That's right.
He's not going to respond. He's going to, you know, let us do it. Well, he responds with a declaration that basically says, if need be, I'm going to send the Army and Navy to South Carolina to enforce the law. So there was that wiggle room. Calhoun's back in South Carolina, back in the Senate. They come up with the Compromise of 1833, which begins a reduction of the tariff. But at the same time, courtesy of Henry Clay, there's the force bill, which says that the president has the authority to use the Army and the Navy to enforce the laws of the land. So that's over for the time being. But in terms of Jackson and Calhoun, the rancor is there. And allegedly, one of Jackson's dying statements was he had two regrets in life. One, that his favorite filly had never won the stakes race in Nashville, and the other, that he had not hanged John C. Calhoun in 1833. Whether that's true or not, but it fits in with character.
It does, and it also reflects that deep-seated need among Southern men in particular to win battles of honor and perception. And, you know, that the Compromise of 1833, the reduction in tariffs, was very much along those lines because it allowed both men to save face. It allowed Jackson to claim that he was acting in the interest of the country and prepared to use force to preserve the nature of the Union. And it allowed Calhoun to say, well, they have accommodated our demands without taking that final step towards succeeding from the Union. But in some ways, I suppose, as important as those instances are to the 1830s, it perhaps is the resonance that might be even more important, because 30 years later, we see the same conversation being rehashed, but with very different results.
Well, and of course, one of the big differences between 1833 and 1859 is that the South Carolinians, who also thought that Jackson's going to be our friend, was that the rest of the South will stand up with us.
Mm-hmm.
It was like somebody says, charge, and they look around and nobody is there. In fact, the rest of the South legislatures condemned South Carolina for being radical.
That's right. So all of these conditional unionists were extremely worried about what they consider the recklessness of the South Carolinian position. Although once it does start, you have this very quick domino effect in the early 1861, except with the Upper South quite wisely waiting to see what happens. But it is, the rhetorical positioning of South Carolina in 1861 is very similar to the nullification crisis. The same arguments are resurrected and emboldened. And in a strange way, I mean, if you to go back to the beginning of our conversation, when we discuss, what we're taught in school about these things, for many years I was taught that, the Civil War ended the conversation about secession and states' rights and nullification. And yet today we see the resurrection of that conversation in a different context, in particular California. And one of the ironies of American history, I think, of the exporting of ideas to different places.
Well, it's interesting, without getting into contemporary politics too much, that politicians who talk about states' rights in one side of the mouth then don't want to hear it about the other. So,
well, this is the great double-edged sword of secession, isn't it?
Hey, you can't have a divorce like that without difficulties, as 1860 showed.
And as John Eaton found out.
And I think, going back to the nullification, South Carolina may eventually, quote, lead, but almost for 30 years, people didn't take South Carolina very seriously. Your firebrands, you're hot-headed, whether it's an oratory or you get the crudeness that came out of the mountain folk in Tennessee and western North Carolina sending a letter to Jackson and said, you don't worry, we're going to all stand on the ridge of the mountain and urinate and flush those secessionists out into the Atlantic mm-hmm. Ocean. Mm-hmm. That's all they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you're right. There is that lack of seriousness, but I mean, in terms of Calhoun's own career, any national ambitions that he harbored suddenly evaporated. I mean, the most that he would become would be a regional leader.
But he never stopped.
He didn't.
Let's talk about, he had opposed, there's that older, but I still think a very good 3-volume biography of Calhoun by Charles Wiltse. Mm-hmm. The middle one, of course, is John C. Calhoun, nationalist, mm-hmm. A man who supported a tariff after the War of 1812, who supported the bank, who supported internal improvements. Mm-hmm. And, of course, particularly federal funds for internal improvements would become anathema after the 1830s, despite it was up to the states to, it was anathema. Mm-hmm. And yet, in the 1840s, when Calhoun's still trying to justify internal improvements in the Mississippi Valley, he calls it, because people said, okay, it's to do something on the coast, but he declares it an inland sea.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He just, he didn't make it. Neither did Henry Clay, the other person who thought he should be president.
Yes, well, Clay was very much like Jackson in a way. I mean, a frontiers chap, a bit rough around the edges, not as rough as Jackson. But, these are voices that, especially Calhoun, is a voice that's going to be increasingly out of step with the larger developments of the nation. Although that ideology sometimes is dormant, but sometimes it has a resurrection. And it's something that is an important part of American history, but it does enormous damage to him, I think, as a possible national leader. And to the state of South Carolina, which is seen, and you're right, as idiosyncratic and bordering on recklessness.
In fact, the events of the 1850s, when there's great discussion, particularly in the South, about the Compromise of 1850, mm-hmm. the admission of California, and upsetting the balance of free states mm-hmm. and slave states in the Senate, South Carolina's push to do something more radical collapses. It even collapses within South Carolina. The radicals can't carry the day in a local, in a statewide election.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, it does make you wonder what the on earth was going on in that autumn and winter of 1860 in some of their minds. Were they aware of their own radical nature? Did they see themselves as radical? Some of them sort of saw themselves as terribly conservative, as preserving something, a kind of preemptive counter-revolution on the basis of what Lincoln might do.
Well, there was that group of South Carolinians who basically decided to take over the movement so that people like Robert Barnwell Rhett could not lead it.
That's right.
That he was too radical.
That's right. Yet it was the only state that voted for secession entirely, unanimously. There was always some division in other southern states, but not South Carolina.
All right, let's get back to Jackson. The 1850 story, that's another conversation. Andrew Jackson, symbol for an age. Yes? Because if you say he's symbol for an age, you're talking about an age that encompasses Boston Brahmins, frontier planters in Mississippi, and settlers in Florida. The nationalism that had started after the War of 1812, is that really coming to fruition in Jackson politically? Because the era good feelings, things are still kind of, they're not firm.
You have to ask yourself, what is the function of periodizing American history in this way? We tend to do this a lot, don't we? What work is it doing to call it the Age of Jackson, a symbol? And we do this with all sorts of presidencies and fields, you know, the Jeffersonian era.
Imperial America. Progressive America.
Reconstruction even, right? So we even have Reconstruction as having very sort of bookended moments. So what work is it doing for us today, I suppose, is the ultimate question. And it helps us understand a very complex time with a very useful shorthand. And many of the things that developed, either directly as a result of Jackson or indirectly as a result of his accidental presidency, do seem to have that feel of a moment in time in American history that was different, and also by way of preface for what followed.
Right, you referred to him as an accidental president. That's what Hadler says.
Right, so
why is he accidental?
Well, accident or by chance, I mean, he loses very narrowly in the first instance, wins very handily in the second. I don't think he could have been president before he was president. I don't think he could have been president sort of 15 years beforehand. It's perfectly possible that he would have been president afterwards, but it was his time in that sense because he was very astute in manipulating perception and public opinion. And he tagged in, either intuitively or deliberately, he tagged into this significant rise in an expansion of the franchise. Mm-hmm. If you look at the rate of participation between 1824 and 1840, I think it's something like 28% of voters participated in elections in 1824. By 1840, that was 78%. And this is a much more vibrant participatory democracy. And Jackson either helped cause that to some extent, but certainly drew on it. And I think in a broadened franchise age, Jackson would not have resonated well. It was still very much a Jeffersonian era in which talent was believed to be part of a natural aristocracy. What Jackson represented was a different kind of leadership, a different kind of politician. So it's not that Jackson was not well educated. He was. He was quite well read. He knew his scripture. His writing wasn't awful or anything like that, although John Quincy Adams belittled him. He was a savvy chap, but that's precisely the point. He recognized that there was an alternative route to political power. I mean, this is a man who not just assumed the presidency, but came to redefine it and was very happy to do so. He saw himself as the custodian of the United States. And I don't think presidents prior to that, but with the exception of Washington, saw themselves in quite the same way or were willing to use the same tools to embolden that office, that executive branch. Now, presidents afterwards certainly did. Lincoln did. FDR loved a veto. In fact, he would often say, just bring me something so I can veto it, to remind the Congress of who the boss is. That was Jackson. Beforehand, Very few presidents issued vetoes. Jackson vetoed happily.
All right. Mark, I am very sorry. Alfred is giving me the wind-up sign. Any last words for our listeners before we sign off?
Well, not really, with the exception of Andrew Jackson, perhaps not a man just for his age, but for others too.
Okay. Mark Smith, Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina, thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
My pleasure.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Mark Smith is an incredible conversationalist and a very, very knowledgeable historian. Our discussion ranged, as you know, from the age of Jackson, Andrew Jackson's symbol for an age, a man of controversy, a very complex individual, a man who helped save the nation, a man who inaugurated the Trail of Tears on which thousands died. It's a complicated story, but history is not always simple, and I think trying to understand Jackson in his time is complicated, but that is part of American history, and it is certainly part of South Carolina history. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.